From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
First this morning, we speak with licensed therapist Hillary Canavy and registered dietitian Dana Sturdivant, who have written Reclaiming Body Trust, A Path to Healing and Liberation. It's a holistic and powerful framework for accepting, liberating our bodies and ourselves.
Then journalist Linda Flanagan. Her writing on sports has appeared in The Atlantic, Runner's World, and NPR's education site, Mindshift. She discusses her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters.
Stay with us. We will be back after these words from our underwriters. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. Now, if you're human, there's a pretty decent chance that at some point you've felt uncomfortable or not at home in your body. What does it take to feel like we can trust our bodies and how they look and how they feel? Our next guests are the founders of something called Body Trust. They are licensed therapist Hillary Canavy and registered dietitian Dana Sturdivant. They invite readers to break free from the status quo and reject a diet culture that they say has taken advantage and profited from trauma, stigma, and disembodiment to fully reclaim and embrace our bodies. Hillary and Dana, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's just start off with, I use those words body image, but your new book is called Body Trust. What's the difference between body image and body trust, Dana?
Body image, certainly improving body image can be a part of body trust, but we don't feel like body image takes it far enough because it kind of focuses on the individual and in changing how they see their bodies while we grow up in a society that disembodies us, disconnects us, and ultimately makes us easier to control. And so we want a body trust helps people develop an analysis around what has come between them and being at home in their bodies. So they're better able to push back against cultural norms and standards to fully embrace their bodies. Body trust is something that we're born with. You know, we don't come into the world fretting about the size of our bellies, our butts, our thighs. It's something that's ruptured, which is why the first part of the book, we talk about the rupture. And so this work is about reclaiming body trust. We believe body trust is a birthright. Like I said, we were born into this world, and somewhere along the way, it gets hijacked. Often over time, we lose parts of ourselves. So I don't know if that explains the difference.
Yeah. It does. It helps me understand. You know, in recent years, there has been this movement towards accepting how we look at the weight we are. I guess I always come up with a sticking point. And you could say that David and I were talking about this in the green room, which is, you know, I've always been aware of my weight, but I've never had the occasion of, you know, being obese or being at a point where I don't feel like I'm healthy in my weight. However, I'm acutely aware of it. And I think that's probably been formed from just living in our society or the fact that my mom was always trying to lose that last 10 pounds or whatever it is. You know, at what point can we look at ourselves as healthy beings, no matter what weight we're at? And Hillary, I don't even know if that makes sense as a question, because, you know, I guess it's this interplay between health and weight. So what would you say about that?
Well, I would say that, you know, I mean, scientifically speaking, we know the BMI is bunk. Like, it's not a measure of health in any way, and was never intended to be so. It's just something that our systems rely on to get a quick measurement, and they call it a vital sign, although there's nothing vital about BMI at all.
So BMI, body mass index.
Yes, exactly. You know, we don't have a weight in which people are intrinsically unhealthy. It is diet culture and it is fat phobia that have taught us that people in larger or fat bodies are unhealthy and people in thin bodies are healthy. Having a fat body does not guarantee ill health, even though the way it's often represented in the media would indicate so. So we've learned as a culture that it's okay for us to believe that and put that upon people in larger bodies, when actually there's a lot of protective elements about fatness. And dieting itself has probably increased the weight of our population over time. And so it's a much more complicated interplay. What has happened is that because there is so much profit in our culture off of fat phobia, all of us are hustling in response to weight stigma and weight bias and these beliefs about bodies. So you, even though you maybe have an experience living in a larger body, you know, have felt perhaps that hustle. And that hustle is something that we're trying to get underneath a little bit in this book, Reclaiming Body Trust. We want to talk about what has pulled everyone's focus towards weight and away from sustainable ways of being in our bodies, or away from loving ourselves as we are. That is something we would like to expose both within ourselves and in the culture.
It's interesting that you talk about the diet culture and the fat phobia, because it is really sad how in society today we have been fed the steady diet of what, you know, in quotes, a perfect body looks like. And it's been happening since the beginning of marketing and branding. And I think from a male's perspective, I'm very curious, do you feel that this culture is more shifted towards the females, you know, as a father of a young woman per se? I think that the female culture is a lot more harsh on individuals, especially young girls. And I'm curious, do you feel in this culture of the fat phobia and diet culture, is it catered more towards one gender or the other?
I think, with the rise of the body positivity movement and social media really giving people who didn't have a voice, we are seeing more people assigned female at birth, pulling away from diet culture and having more criticism of it, and not dieting and engaging in many of these popular weight loss programs. And so the diet industry actually sees men as an untapped market. And I think we will be seeing them going after people assigned male at birth. You know, it's not often so much for men about being thin as it is about being fit and lean, which are just code words for, you know, thin. And, you know, it's more about six pack abs and having a certain, you know, my body look a certain way for men. So, you know, I think few of us are immune to this at this point. I think it's so pervasive and it's only gotten worse over time. That, you know, young boys in high school, junior high, are even getting obsessed with perfecting food in their eating.
I would agree with that. And, you know, in the intro to your book, one of the first questions you say you ask individuals is, how did you first learn your body was a problem? Or what has come between you and feeling at home in your body? And these are really deep questions to ponder for an individual. What are some of the common themes you see individuals for reasons they decide to attend your workshops or start taking that next step into body trust?
Most people have internalized messages from early on that their body is a problem, and those can come from a lot of different sources. I mean, they come from parents who are trying to protect kids from becoming fat kids. or experiencing weight bias. It comes from physicians very often, school curriculums. But then we also, you know, see that if you're a non-white kid, if you are not a straight kid, if you are a trans kid, there's a lot of messages about everything that isn't enough about you. There's a huge deficiency that people are being labeled as not enough, you know, and everything. Diet culture has offered a solution to a lot of this, right? Diet culture says if you do all the things right, you can become more, you can become whiter, you can become safer, you can become more like dominant culture. And those practices and those early messages tend to disconnect people and take them on a path of having this body project throughout their lives.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Hillary Canavy and Dana Sturtevant. They've written a new book called Reclaiming Body Trust, A Path to Healing and Liberation. And I wanted to thank you. I can't remember if it's Hillary or Dana who gave me a new vocabulary. I found myself struggling over or kind of tripping over my words when I was mentioning that I have not lived in you gave me the words a larger body, and I use the word obese. And I even wonder, because obesity is kind of subjective, isn't it? You know, when you were talking about how the body mass index is kind of off and wrong, it only is being applied to this one certain type of body, which may not even include those people who just have a lot of bones that are very heavy and dense. And that even skews a body mass index and what you might be called. I've had people who I would no more describe as living in a larger body or that word obesity. And they say, yeah, on the body mass index, that's where I am. And maybe it's someone who has a different bone structure, or maybe they have lots of muscle. And it does seem very skewed. Can you go into that a little bit deeper, Hillary, so that we know, and if our kids are on that, and you know, they're being shown that they might be on the heavy side or something like that, so that we can recalibrate the way we think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important to know that the BMI was created by a mathematician who was looking at the distribution of a population's weight. It was not intended to describe health. And, you know, the BMI was made for men, you know, in the 1800s. Like, we're not talking about something that's really used to describe all the variants of bodies in our culture. We've also learned that a lot of his science and methodology were being greatly informed by eugenics at the time. So we know now that the BMI is rooted in white supremacy as well. And yet it's used every day in every medical office. And yeah, there's, you know, if you Google it, you'll find out that so-and-so who's really muscle bound is in a big category of the BMI or whatever. I think what's most important is that we understand is that there's always been fat bodies and there always will be fat bodies, and that our culture's focus on eradicating fat or valuing muscle over fat or valuing this body type over others is having a huge effect on people's lives and is incredibly discriminatory. It's harming people. And that these practices we try to couch in conversations about health, but they're really about exclusion. They're really about hierarchy, body hierarchy, and they're creating ill health. I don't know anyone that can feel well while obsessed about improving their bodies. I don't find that to, as a therapist, I don't find that to be a state of psychological wellness or emotional wellness. And yet we tend to decouple emotional wellness and psychological wellness almost immediately when we start to think about weight. And I don't know why we do that other than we've been well trained to do so.
Absolutely. One of you spoke in the beginning, briefly mentioned that if you look at the data, dieting really only assures that there will be weight gain. Dana, can you go into that a little bit more? That's so interesting and I so believe it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when people come to see us initially, something that I often hear is, you know, I'd love to weigh what I weighed when I started dieting. And I say, oh, and how did you feel about your body back then when you started dieting? And they thought, oh, I thought I was disgusting. And now looking back in hindsight, they're like, I would be fine with that body today. And actually research shows, it's not the research touted in most media outlets. And many of our colleagues have written extensively to push back on the dominant weight paradigm. And for one reason being that there's no evidence-based weight loss program out there that leads to sustained weight loss when you look at the data 5 to 10 years out. And so when a program says that it works, it often works in the short term, especially the first time you try it or the first time you're dieting. When you're early on in your life dieting, you know, some of these programs work in the short term. I'm putting work in air quotes. And by 2 years out, people gain the weight back and then some. So when a program tells you it works, ask for their 5 to 10 year outcome data and expect crickets. What research actually shows is that the most consistent effect of weight loss at 2 years is weight gain. And so the best way to help people gain weight over the course of their life is to encourage them to suppress their weight below what is natural, their body naturally wants to be. And so we can be there and, you know, kind of diet our healthy lifestyle our way up the scale and continue to blame ourselves. And, you know, many people start to see that, like, and know that I can't expect something different by trying the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And so that's sometimes hitting that, you know, hitting that space of being like, I can't keep doing this. We say often the first time phase of body trust is acknowledging that you can't go back, that it hasn't worked, it's not going to work. So acknowledging that you can't keep doing this, you can't go back, even though you don't know how to go forward. And this book is really about helping people figure out how do we move forward from that.
Hillary, you mentioned the word exclusion, which really struck a chord with me, because you talk about in the book how not everyone's going to understand what you're going through and people in your circle. And I've noticed this myself when I decide that I'm going to give up something like alcohol for a month. And when I'm going out with my friends, my social circles, it is the norm to be having a drink with the group. And when I let individuals know that I'm not partaking in this particular activity for this week, month, whatever it is, there is some shaming behind it. And for myself, I've noticed that the best way to do it is to kind of fake it and just go and have a fake cocktail and not let everyone know that I'm actually partaking in this particular thing for myself. And so to not feel excluded, what do you encourage your clients to do when they're going through your sessions? Do you encourage them to let the group know and understand what they're going through and working with? Or do you just encourage them to kind of just take their own path and journey quietly?
You know, when people are at the beginning stages of this, it's often so new to them that they don't have the language yet themselves to describe what this is for them or what it is. So we practice boundary statements usually, like, I'm not doing that today, or I don't feel like talking about bodies today. Let's not talk about this anymore. Or I'm just finding talking about food isn't good for me. I'm not going to be talking about food. Or to stay away in the beginning stages of this from folks that intuitively know can't support their exploration and their new path. I think both are really vital, but I do think it really helps to have some boundary statements practiced beforehand and be clear in our own selves about our intuition, about who can really support us and who can't. That's a lot of information about who we're with too. If we have to fake it or if we can't tell the truth, I'm guessing then there isn't a pathway to really be deeply understood or share feelings. And these processes we undertake to change ourselves or to come out of something that hasn't been good for us are deeply vulnerable. And it's really important that we get adequately met in that, that we get seen and held. And if that's not happening, we deserve to protect ourselves.
So to find that pathway, Dana, where do you recommend that individuals that are having a tough time with body trust, where should they start? Is it confiding with their particular friend group, their family, or is it finding online groups, or what's a good path for someone to take initially when they're trying to take this journey?
Yeah, I mean, finding community is a huge part of this healing work. We find, you know, Hillary and I developed this approach, sitting in rooms and groups and facilitating this process with people. And you can sit one-on-one and do this exploration in therapy with a dietitian. And we have noticed that when people come to our retreats or workshops and they explore this work in community with a community of people who are also exploring it and support their liberation, that their healing shifts. It kind of moves the process forward. So we encourage people to find at least one person that they can talk to about this that supports them. They may not understand it. Like Hillary said, it's like learning to speak a new language. It's very countercultural, and people often, you know, if they haven't explored it themselves, it can be confusing. And so finding one person who at least can hold space so you can talk about it, they may not agree with you, but they're not pushing back against you. And we know that membership in equitable community is part of coming home to our bodies. You know, being in a space that's fat affirming, that where we don't feel judged about our bodies, where we can talk more openly about what the struggle has been like and how we've been harmed by it, and having people really see that and understand it and really rally around our liberation can make a huge difference. So that, and for some people that may be, you know, finding groups online. We recommend curating your social media account so that you're seeing messages that support this. Sometimes the community is just that. Some of our clients make a second, you know, Instagram account that's just filled with voices in this space, so that when they're having a rough day and their friend is dieting, they don't have to be on their normal Instagram. They go to this body trust Instagram where they just see these messages and get flooded with these things. But that's what I would say. Some kind of support makes a huge difference.
It seems to me that there is a lot of hope in this whole realm, because I've seen, for many years, and as I was growing up, if you looked at any catalog with pictures of, you know, a woman, especially, I think of modeling clothing, it was always someone that was what we, I think, would consider now unhealthy because they're so thin. But back then, that was the perfect body. And now I don't know about you all, but the catalogs and that I receive, like Athleta and Title IX, and, you know, those are the things I tend to look at because those are my kind of clothing. I see women of all, you know, many different body shapes and sizes. I mean, I still think it's within parameters, but I think that now we're starting to see curves. And that word voluptuous, it's all, the curves are a beautiful thing. And seeing the very skinny, skinny, skinny body as looking, it looks to me now like that's not healthy. Do you find the same thing now? Or do you still think that's under limits and parameters? Hillary?
I think it's changing. I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of clothing companies be willing to extend their line to like a 2X or a 3X, which is really different. And then also making the connection that if you're going to sell those clothes, you could have those models available showing those clothes, you know, that took a while to get there too. And so it is nice to see this kind of broader range. And there are also a few clothing companies that actually go up to a size 40 and beyond, which is actually what we want to be seeing is a broader range. But what we know for sure about media is that representation matters and has a huge impact. So if we're seeing folks of all sizes and all shapes, and if we're seeing people in varying levels of abilities, and we're seeing different gender representations, that is going to have a huge impact on people's ability to live well in their bodies as they are.
The book is Reclaiming Body Trust. It's a path to healing and liberation. Our guests are Hillary Canavy and Dana Sturdivant. Best of luck to you. This is such a great topic. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us where else you can be found, Dana.
Yeah, you can find us at centerforbodytrust.com. And on Instagram, Facebook, we are Center for Body Trust. And on Twitter, we are Body Trust Center.
Wonderful. Hillary, Dana, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And again, Hillary Canavy and Dana Sturdivant, and their book is Reclaiming Body Trust, A Holistic Approach to Accepting Our Bodies. This is The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. We'll be back after these words. We'll be talking about kids in sport and how that whole industry, well, needs to be kept in check, shall we say, with Linda Flanagan when we return. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. Please enjoy this interview about kids in sport that I had with Linda Flanagan a couple of days ago. My next guest, Linda Flanagan, is a freelance journalist, a researcher, and former cross-country and track coach. She's a founding board member of the New York City chapter of the Positive Coaching Alliance and an advisory group member for the Aspen Institute's Reimagining Sports Initiative. Her writing on sports has appeared all over, including The Atlantic, Runner's World, and NPR's education site, Mindshift. She joins me now to discuss her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda Flanagan, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
There are some pretty clear and I would say astonishing sort of allegations about kids in sport. Well, I'm just going to start by reading this. 40 years of research conducted by more than 20 researchers studying tens of thousands of athletes and non-athletes from all levels simply does not support the notion of sport as a character building activity, particularly as it applies to sportsmanship behaviors and moral reasoning ability. So this statement is, it's a big one, especially for, as I'm sure you're aware, Park City as one of the hosts of the 2002 Olympics and constantly, I mean, one of our missions here is to involve kids in sport. How did you arrive at this statement?
Well, first I'd like to add that I'm a big believer in sports myself. I think they're vital and essential for kids and adults, and that's one reason why I wanted to write the book. I arrived at that statement based on the research I, you know, came upon, and particularly the study that was looked at, a meta-analysis of 40 years of research and said, look, there's no evidence that sports build character. Now, that's not to say that they can't. What it's saying is that sports are basically an empty vessel. They're what we make of them. They're not inherently character building. They can be character building under the right circumstances. It's not like if you throw your kids in sports, suddenly they're going to come out of it better people. It depends on the coach. It depends on the culture. It just depends on so many factors that are not, that people, I guess, aren't really thinking about, perhaps, that I allude to the sociologist Jay Coakley, who writes about the great sports myth that sports are inherently good, and we like to think this, but it's not necessarily the case. And I made that statement also to remind readers that, you know, you can't just make too many assumptions about what your children are getting out of this activity. That being said, they can be great. And I personally was a beneficiary. I feel like I grew a lot in my sports experiences. I think most people who had some kind of athletic experience growing up can point to something that they think had a big impact on them, positive for good or bad.
You know, when I was a kid and I would watch the Olympics and I would see maybe like a Russian gymnast, and then you would hear these stories that seemed quite unbelievable about how these gymnasts were taken from their homes and they were put into this gymnastics school with these harsh coaches, and the hours were incredible that they had to hone their sport. It all seemed so harsh and so unreasonable for a young person. And yet that story is happening right around us every single day now when we send our kids away to a ski school, a ski boarding school, or whatever it is. I'm just wondering if the place that we are right now with our kids in sport, it's so different from when you and I were kids, mm-hmm. where you'd play multiple sports and you know, maybe by the time you got to high school, you would start to specialize, but maybe not. Maybe you do three different sports in a competitive way. I'm just wondering, you know, it all starts off with the best intentions, I think, mm-hmm. from coaches and parents. Mm-hmm. And how does it go awry?
You know, I feel like it becomes, this is why one of the subtitle of the book is about mania. I think it just becomes, just takes on a life of its own. It becomes too important. And, you know, I think as more is expected of kids and more is expected of parents and in terms of what they're supposed to give up, it becomes like, what is the expression? A sunk cost. You know, you can't give it up because you've already put so much into it. Then at the same time, you know, so if you're a parent, you've devoted a lot of money and time and a child, and you've put, you know, good years of your life into this. And then, you know, there's outsiders, adults, coaches, whoever, you know, whispering in your ear about what this can do for you. Maybe it'll get you into a better college. Maybe you'll get recruited. Maybe you'll get some money. Then it's like, well, I may not like it, but if I can just hold on a little longer. It takes on a life of its own, and all of the money and the expense and sacrifice just makes it last longer. That's my understanding of it anyway.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Linda Flanagan. She's written a new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. I think we probably, as parents, all have a story about our children in sport that gives us pause or makes us think, are we doing the right thing? Mine came when my son was in ski racing in high school, and he went on, it did help him get into a good college. He ski raced for an NCAA school. Did he love it? I don't know. At the end of the day, he said, I won't have my kids ski race. And you know, I kind of laughed at him because I said, this was all your choice. Nevertheless, it was about the time, I don't know, maybe he was a sophomore in high school, when suddenly in the summertime, they had to fly to South America to train. We thought, this is ridiculous. Like, can't you just have a normal summer? And is it really going to up your game that much as a ski racer? And nevertheless, we didn't sort of, like you're talking about, we didn't know how to say no. Mm-hmm. And we scraped our pennies together. It wasn't an easy thing. There was one family who said, we're not doing this. We are not sending our ski racer to Chile. This is ridiculous. They are 15 years old. This doesn't need to happen. And I have so much respect for that family, mm-hmm. because they didn't get sucked in. And mm-hmm. so how as parents do we not, how do we decipher between what's important, what money we're going to spend, what time we're going to spend, you know, mm-hmm. what we're going to subject our kids to?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question, you know? I mean, I think it all comes down to being aware of what your values are and what's important to you, you know, and why are you doing this? What are you doing this for? If you can be honest with yourself, you as, you know, as parents and as a child as well, like, what are we doing this for? And what is important to us? And is this activity contributing to what's important to our family? I often think, you know, about when you leave, go home from the hospital with your baby, you know, you go back in time and you think how the possibilities you have in mind when you go home and you think what you have fantasies about what your family life might be like and what, you know, these like nice little images about what it can be. And did you ever imagine that it would be spent in 20 hours a week in the car or watching games or sending kids all over the place? It just seems so at odds with what we have, I think, what most of us want for our families. And I think if you can kind of go back to your first principles of what do you want? What do you want for your family? Do you want to be apart? Do you want to be have every weekend divided? One parent going one place with one kid and another going somewhere else with another kid. Like, what is important to you? And if, like, you started the question by saying, you know, we all had that moment. It sounds like your moment was when do we or do we not send our teenager to Chile in the summer? You know, that's like, that's the moment when you kind of have to make that decision on your own and just try to be as honest as possible about what you're trying to do. And is it worth the sacrifice? And of course, how much does the child want it? It has to come from the kid. If the parents are like, this will be good for you, you should do it, you should do it. That's probably not a good sign. But it sounds like your son really wanted to do it. And even if he has regrets now, or that wouldn't do it with his own children, at the time that he felt strongly about it.
Yeah, I would say that we as parents, you know, we look at the situation and, you know, I think most parents would say the reason we got our kids into sport is to give them something to do, to keep them out of trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's true. You know, if you have to wake up on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. to travel to a competition, you're probably not getting in trouble on Friday night. You know, these are good things, but the way that we as parents can really help reinforce the positive message of sport, because I think there are so many, and I know you agree mm-hmm. with that. If you look at the youth sports industry, you say that it's now worth more than $19 billion, and that's a 90% increase since 2010. And so what is going on here? That is concerning, I would say. it's something that, you know, we have to keep in mind as parents and coaches that this is going on.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I have had my moments too, where I'm like, what are we doing here? And just trying to square my own experience growing up with sports and how my parents viewed it with where we are now. And, you know, I was troubled by my own strong feelings about my son's games and performance, like caring too much. And so I was just curious about, well, how did we get here? So that's when I started, you know, doing some research. And there are these larger forces at work outside the home that have gotten us to where we are. You know, I certainly don't want to just blame parents for making bad decisions. I mean, there's this whole ecosystem at work that is kind of pushing us down this road of excess. And money is a big part of it. If the industry was estimated at $19 billion versus the NFL's $15 billion, I mean, there's a lot of people profiting off your family. And I think it's always good to have a little skepticism in mind to realize that, you know, someone is benefiting from, you know, your kid's athleticism, and to keep, you know, just be skeptical. I think parents ought to be a little more skeptical about some of the claims. The other sort of large, you could almost call it an environmental factor, is the change perspective on childhood. And this is such an, I think, fascinating kind of exploration for me, this whole idea of how did we get from where our kids have taken such center stage in our lives for parents. And, you know, the great journalist Jennifer Senior put it, the way she described it is, children have moved from our employees to our bosses. And I think that really feels true to me in a way that I know it wasn't true for my parents. Probably wasn't true for your parents and your growing up. And so how do we get here? And there are changes that are related to economic anxiety, to concerns about stranger danger, sprawled, more divorce, higher divorce rates that have gotten and fewer kids, you know, families having fewer kids, to the point where the way we view our children has shifted so that they have become more a reflection of us and our abilities as parents. How they do is a reflection on us, more so than in previous generations. Of course, all parents are proud of their kids and want them to do well. I'm sure yours were, mine were, but their egos weren't attached to our success as much as more modern families are. So that's the second giant sort of overlay on the youth sports universe. And the third is these changes at colleges and universities that are another source of anxiety and incentive for families to go all into youth sports. Because as we know, tuition costs are staggeringly high. There's the perception that it's much harder to get in. And meanwhile, there's this prospect of playing for a college team, maybe getting recruited, maybe getting a little money, getting into a better college. You know, the amount of money that's dangled before athletes has grown exponentially. It's now $3.6 billion that in scholarship, athletic scholarship aid. Not many are going to get that, but some will, and it's enticing. So these, you know, it's the money, it's the changed perception of children, and then these giant shifts at colleges and universities that have sort of, you know, become a toxic brew and made youth sports so high stakes and overwhelming.
What are the biggest myths or fallacies that parents don't often know about when it comes to, you know, you have this aspiration or your child has this aspiration of playing a sport in college? It sounds great. It gives them an immediate community with whom, you know, they've got this little built-in family, right, when they get to college, and they've got the support of a coach who can be sort of like a, you know, an in-place parent to a certain degree. But there are surprises. There are surprises.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no scholarship money, for example, and the kid is going off to a very expensive college. Or
there's a lot. Well, and I always want to preface, I feel like whenever I say something negative about sports, I always want to preface it by saying I love them and that sports are great. Some college kids can take it and it suits them fine and they love it. Great. I think it's the kids who are going into playing college and their parents probably may not recognize how incredibly demanding it is, much more so than if you ever played in college yourself. I would encourage every parent and child who's pursuing this to go home and Google the GOALS surveys, G-O-A-L-S, the NCAA puts out every couple of years. And it's a kind of in-depth survey of about 20,000 athletes, college athletes, about their experiences. So it's unfiltered, you know, and you can really get insight into what that experience is like. And in the 2019 survey, Division One athletes revealed that they spent about 33 hours a week on their sports, their in season, and versus 35 hours a week on their academics. So that's like essentially a 70 hour work week. They all refer to it as a job. It's a job. Also revealed in that study is that they got an average of 6 hours and 15 minutes of sleep a night. You know, and I don't know about you, but that would be hard for me. And for young people who are growing and who are exercising so much, it's just an enormous strain. I mean, this is, I do think, you know, while college sports can be a refuge for some kids and the coach might be wonderful, it is a job with enormous, enormous repercussions on kids' lives. And a good chunk of them, some 30% of girls and 25% of boys said, the load was too much and it was just getting to be too much to handle for them. So I think that we have to go approach these things with, again, skepticism and like realism about what are we doing here? Many kids don't like college sports once they're in it. It's not what they had hoped for necessarily. It's a grind. It's a real grind. Coaches can be kind of jerky. They have their problems as well. They've got to produce wins. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It's just that they have their own pressures on them too. So I think, you know, everyone needs to be really well informed about what that college program is like and what the expectations are. And Division III, while in theory less competitive and less demanding, and that is true to some extent, the stakes there are rising as well. So it's not like there's some easy place to go and play in college. I just think people really need to be conscious of that.
You're making me think about our second son who grew up ski racing as well, but stopped midway through high school and then in college joined the club team for ski racing. And he said, I have never had so much fun ski racing. It's about the team. It's about team points. It's like a big party every weekend. He loved it. Linda, I wanted to ask you, have just a couple minutes left, but about early specialization. You know, a child, I think we heard at age 9 on the soccer team, the club soccer team, that it was time to commit to the sport and give up the other sports. And I remember thinking that was so ludicrous at the time. And even, you know, that was one where I said, no, I'm not going to buy into this. This is not right. And nevertheless, you know, by high school, they are specializing. And, you know, what happens if they get injured and then they can't go do, you know, just join some other sport because all those kids have specialized since their early teens. Mm-hmm. What do mm-hmm. we do about this?
Well, you know, that is a giant problem because the reality is that if you have been practicing a sport since you were 6, you are going to be more skilled, most likely, in high school. That is true for some sports. However, it's also, there's a good chance that a child who begins specializing at a young age is going to quit because they're sick to death of it. They'll get burned out. They'll get injured. They won't want to play anymore. So by the time that, you know, your son or daughter who hasn't, you know, didn't play soccer from age 5 solely, by the time your son or daughter gets to high school, there might be more openings available. The child who hasn't been narrowly focused on one sport will just have a better attitude towards the sport, will be more excited about the sport. And, you know, again, it kind of depends on, this is what I was getting to about values and what's important to you. Like, what do you want for your child out of sports? Is it so that they can, you know, grit their teeth and make the team? Or is it that they can experience some joy in athletics and a variety of athletics? And, you know, so they don't make, what if they don't make the soccer team because they didn't specialize? It's not the end of the world. They could try the cross country team or, you know, do something else after school for a season. You know, I think there needs to be more understanding of some of the trade-offs, like is the sacrifice of this worth it? You know, what are we trying to do here? If, like, look at your son, the ski racer, who's playing for his club team. He's loving it. It's fun. He's more apt to continue being athletic and active. And that would seem to me to be the whole purpose to begin with, to encourage a love of movement and exercise.
Linda, there's a new model, and perhaps I'm very biased because I love mountain biking, but there is this, you know, National Mountain Biking Association that has started in high school, and it's huge here. Well, in Park City, that's sort of obvious because mountain biking is a big sport. But I think the bottom line here is just to involve kids. It doesn't matter what level you're on. It doesn't matter if you've never mountain biked before. You are welcome. It's inclusive. It gives scholarship. And there are all these different levels that you can choose. And I think, you know, now I'm seeing literally hundreds and thousands of kids in Utah joining this. And so I'm wondering if you, in your research as a, you know, as a professional, are seeing more models like this where both parents and coaches and, you know, programs are being developed out of what you're talking about, is we need to do this differently.
You know, I've not heard of that example. And I think that it's a wonderful organic kind of alternative that I think, you know, it sounds like something that ought to be promoted because there are alternatives. You know, I guess the closest analogy I could think of is something like in colleges where ultimate frisbee has become kind of a thing. It's not obviously not like a varsity sport, but kids are playing because they want to play and it's fun and there's not adults, you know, keeping score and insisting they tuck in their shirts. I think this is what we're going to see happening, a movement away as, you know, a more organic kind of retreat to sports for what they're meant to be. And I love that example. And I think, you know, you have that with like running clubs too, where there's, it's like, come one, come all, you run with who you want to, you kind of naturally separate based on your ability. That sounds wonderful.
Well, the book is Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. My guest is Linda Flanagan. And Linda, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, I feel like during our conversation, it is hard to have the right balance because sport is great for kids. Mm-hmm. And we both agree on that. And I think any of our listening audience would. It's just what I feel like you're doing quite well is trying to grow an awareness of the right kind of involvement and how we can conduct ourselves as parents and as coaches and directors of programs.
Yeah. And many parents I know that know this and coaches too. There's a lot of people who want to do it the right way and feel kind of frustrated and lost. And it's not easy to fix. So, you know, you might just have to do it within your own home, at least start there.
Absolutely. Linda, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life. Great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. You can always access our archive shows at our podcast, KPCW The Mountain Life. You can find that anywhere you get podcasts, as well as on our website, kpcw.org, under the Shows tab and The Mountain Life. Stay tuned now for National Public Radio News from Washington.